I have a green. Oh no. Ah, yes. Well, thanks for that. Okay. Thanks to Eric. You now have sound. There is a green light here, right? Which was on, but it was slightly on, and that I mistook for being working. But of course, I should have noticed that you don't have any echo. Okay, so a very quick recap. So we're discussing about the European Cybersecurity Strategy, and as I said, this started in 2013, but it took 3 years to consolidate and come to an agreement between the Parliament and the Commission, and this is not unusual. This is the common practice between these two bodies at the European level. Okay, so then we have to revise it. So this coming September, there will be a revision of this, which will also include the mandate of ENISA, the European Agency for Network and Information Security. So this will be probably upgraded, hopefully upgraded. I think that the timeline is doing well. So yes, there will be a new proposal in September 2017. In fact, there is a proposal, and the process is now being accelerated. It is, I think, at the stage of the public consultation with everyone. You might want to take part to it. I mean, it's for all European citizens, and of course for EFTA country citizens, so you might want to take part in the discussion. What is interesting here, that the revision will touch upon additional measures on standards and certification. Now, certification is a difficult issue because you have to reconcile the industry needs, the industry wishes, and of course financial interests of industry, not only European but also foreign industry. Let's hope that this will come up with something that is reasonable and that can be enforced in practice. Now, the strategy, the existing one, builds upon some principles, and this is important to have in any cybersecurity strategy. So the principles that govern the European cybersecurity strategy, first of all, is that the core values apply as much in the digital as in the physical world. So the idea is that we don't come up with a strategy that would violate the core values. Whatever we have in the physical world, we should have in the digital world as well. This is a principle. Another principle is that, which can be derived from the first one practically, is that the strategy should be protecting fundamental rights, the freedom of expression, personal data, and privacy. So the guidance given here is that we should not sacrifice privacy or fundamental human rights for increased cybersecurity. Access for all, this is a principle because the cybersecurity strategy falls under the more general umbrella of policies for digital Europe. So it's not only about securing infrastructures, but it's also about ensuring that everyone will have the possibility for access. Democratic and efficient multi-stakeholder governance, so not one stakeholder will take care of all that, and that should be on the basis of democratic principles. Shared responsibility, everyone should take their share of ensuring cybersecurity in Europe. And then come some strategic priorities and actions. One is to achieve cyber resilience. So you see already in the European strategy that the concept and the notion of resilience comes into play. So the paradigm has shifted. We're not only concerned with securing our infrastructures, we're also concerned with resilience because we assume that there will be attacks and this will be successful. Another strategic priority is to drastically reduce cybercrime, to develop cyber defense policy and capabilities, which would be related to the common security and defense policy of the European Union, that's related to the physical world. also develop industrial and technological resources. That means putting money into that. This is the interpretation of it. And well, part of the interpretation of this strategy is the policy for reinforcing and enhancing the research on cybersecurity, which we have witnessed in the European framework for research and development, the one which is running now, which you might have heard about by the name of Horizon 2020. Then establish a coherent international cyberspace policy for the European Union and promote core European values. So the idea is not to have every nation by itself, but all this should contribute to establishing a European secure cyberspace. And the graphical depiction of how the different network and information security authorities, including the CERTS, law enforcement, and so on, are seen under this strategy. You can see here. So this is the national level here, and this is the European level. You have national CERTs. You have several authorities in each country. These are different. We discussed those in the case of Norway. Then when it comes to law enforcement, you have, of course, national cybercrime units. You must have heard things like that from in the forensics course, probably, like Kripos and like the ECHO unit, the economic cybercrime unit of the Norwegian police in the Norwegian case. And then you have, of course, defense, where national defense and security authorities are there. All of these have cooperation among them. And then when you come to the European level, then you have, of course, the Commission and the ENISA. Then you have the European CERT, a network of competent authorities, and EPR3, which is a partnership, an abbreviation for partnership here for protection and resilience. Law enforcement is the European cybercrime units. This is the EC3 and Europol, and then it's CEPOL and Eurojust. These are judiciary bodies at the European level, and then there's at the defense level, the European Defense Agency, and competent authorities around that. What is interesting here is this. So the role of industry and academia into the overall cybersecurity picture at the European level is acknowledged directly. This comes from the cybersecurity strategy itself. This is not the case in all national strategies. And, well, it would be nice if it were. Now, if you look at the, on the other hand, at the United States, the American cybersecurity approach, what we have here, this has been a long story there. They have it for several years, but they didn't call it necessarily cybersecurity approach, but they called it information assurance in earlier days. There were some explicit policies there for critical infrastructures and also for the private sector. Now, the government sector that was represented in these policies is taken care of at least partly by the Department of Homeland Security, and also these strategies cover the defense sector as well. When it comes to capabilities in America, they have been built over longer periods, but what has been acknowledged openly is, of course, the existence of the Cyber Command, and this was established in 2009 as a four-star, which means that the four-star general is in charge of that, I think. The United States government has confirmed that there are offensive cyber activities, so this is an established fact now. But of course, later on, the capabilities after, let's say, 2012, that have been revealed are somewhat more accidental, and this does include somehow the Snowden revelations about cybersecurity in the U.S. and other countries. What is interesting, so if you look at it from a military point of view, the President of the United States is again the supreme commander of the, well, as he is, of course, the supreme commander of the armed forces, and that means that he can also initiate or order to have initiated hostile acts that include cyber attacks against the U.S. economy, government, or military. He has the right to retaliate such attacks with either kinetic or cyber response options, and this is actually what is stated here. Okay, now, take a look at other national cybersecurity strategies. These are probably the most, let's say, prominent ones, the European and the American one. What would you say that is the biggest difference, if you were to name one difference between the European cybersecurity strategy and the American strategy? Of course, you only have an outline here, right? I guess you have not read the reading material again, but but relying on what has been presented, what would you say would be the biggest difference in those two approaches? Any takings? Well, I would say it's the link to the military. Well, there were no takings, right? I would say it's the link to the military. And the American cybersecurity strategy has direct links to defense, military defense, whereas the European cybersecurity strategy barely mentions military defense. Right? Now that you have the hint, any thoughts on why this is the case? Yes. Okay, good. We have a taking. Yes, come on. That's the main reason, of course, yes, that there is no common European defense. Well, there is some basic elements, but the policy, the defense policies and strategies are very different. So there is no joint one, and therefore it would make no sense to link cybersecurity strategy to the military at the European level. That doesn't mean that the nations, the member states, do not link their cybersecurity strategies to the military defense, of course. Okay, so let's take a look at some of them. I'm not going through details of countries, I'll just give you an overview of the big picture. So there are various maturity levels at these strategies, and of course the approaches do vary in a number of aspects. One aspect is the roles and priorities among law enforcement, defense, and intelligence capabilities. So you could see the whole picture from law enforcement taking the lead, or maybe military and or defense and intelligence capabilities taking the lead in the strategy, and so on and so forth, depending on the nation. The extent of the integration of the efforts of the private sector to the strategy. In some cases, there is very little integration of the private sector, and everything is, or most, is left up to governments. Then the transparency in revealing the intentions and the capabilities of the country involved is more limited. This sometimes is done so as to hold back information that the adversaries could use. But on the other hand, there is a counter argument that when you do publicize your capabilities, that could deter possible adversaries from taking action against you. And mostly what we see is that continuity of life is one of the common goals in all those cybersecurity strategy, in meaning that critical infrastructure protection is crucial and the central element in these strategies. Now, most of the countries have an explicit cybersecurity strategy in addition to critical infrastructure protection strategies. Not many beyond Western nations and supranational bodies like the EU that we already discussed, NATO, and of course countries like Australia, Canada, Denmark, and all these. I will give you an overview of the situation in Europe, how many countries we have with cybersecurity strategies and not, and of course the Russian Federation in this case. Most of these strategies do point out cyber threats, with the exception of notable exception of Finland and Germany, at least the ongoing versions. Now, I must admit that it looks better on my screen, but you can make it out. This is the situation as it was, I think, some months ago, but I don't think it has changed, really. So these are the European member states, of course. The green ones do have a cybersecurity strategy in place. The yellow ones, of course, do not. And, of course, it's not surprising that Greece doesn't have one. But it is surprising that Sweden doesn't have one. Well, this is a technicality, though. And, in fact, I should have changed that. I should have checked that. But I think it's a technicality because it at the time that this map was created, it hadn't passed through the parliament. So a strategy exists. But, when talking European, people have to tick boxes. And the last box that needs to be ticked in the case of a cybersecurity strategy is whether this has gone through the parliament or the legislative body of the country and has been publicly made available as a legal document or as a governmental document. Of course, Norway doesn't show there because this is strictly the European Union member states. This doesn't give you any indication at all on how good these strategies are. Okay? It's only a tick box. We have it. That's it. Good. Well, doesn't then the question arise, can we in some way assess how good a cybersecurity strategy is? I mean, one could simply, or a member state could simply put a few words on a piece of paper, pass it through the parliament, and then that's it. remember the country with only two critical infrastructures identified? And I'm sure that that Greece, when it comes up with a cybersecurity strategy, it could very well go for a very short document so that the box is ticked, but no substance is beyond that. So ENISA undertook the task of coming up with an evaluation framework of how good these cybersecurity strategies are. This was not the only one. There have been several research papers that have discussed evaluation frameworks. But this is still, I think, the most comprehensive one, and this is why I want to discuss this with you. So the basic idea on which this is built upon is there is a blueprint logic model which presents conceptual building blocks and the structure for a cybersecurity strategy. And then a list of possible key performance indicators for judging how well a nation is doing with regards to its cybersecurity strategy. Now, this is only one part of the blueprint for the logic model. It is just for you, I'll use it as an example for you to see how it works as a methodology. So, what you have here. Oh yeah, I should. That's a bit difficult. I will need to. Hopefully, audio will follow me. Okay, so here it's a column with inputs. There is a column with activities. Then it's a column with outputs, and then there are three columns that are labeled outcomes in the short term, the medium term, and the long term. Okay. And this is just an example. So here, these are inputs at the level of legislation, adopting the strategy, and so on. And these boxes constitute different inputs, which then lead to activities. These activities lead to outputs, and these outputs lead to outcomes, short-term, mid-term, and long-term. Okay, so this is the way, in this way you can actually see the full picture of what a strategy should look like, what it should have, what the process of developing it should be, and so on and so forth. It is guidance, of course, for nations. Okay, so if at any time in your career you were asked to contribute to developing a cybersecurity strategy, this is no one man's effort, of course, right? It takes a lot of development work, and of course it takes a lot of negotiation, internal negotiation, to come up with a cybersecurity strategy, a meaningful cybersecurity strategy. But this is, let's say, a roadmap of how one could move. Okay, now since this is the roadmap, then what are the key performance indicators that we can use? Well, these go along with the key objectives that can have been defined in this framework. So, key objective one was to develop cyber defense policy and capabilities. And you, what we will now see, of course, not in much detail, but I will focus on a couple of those, is a series of tables, each one for every key objective. And then for each key objective, a number of key performance indicators is given. And then the evidence that we should be looking for to see the extent to which this KPI is achieved. By the way, are you familiar with the term KPI? Key performance indicator? More or less? Well, I mean, it's self-evident, but yeah, okay. It's a tool used in management, of course, to measure how well we are doing against predefined goals. And, of course, it is used also in information security management as well. Okay, so this is the first key objective. That if you go on, the second one is whether cyber resilience is achieved, develop capabilities, and efficient cooperation with public and private sector. Actually, if you look at the key objectives, they do map well against the European cybersecurity strategy main objectives. You can see a mapping between those, and this is natural. I mean, ENISA being a European agency, their primary responsibility is, of course, to the European Union as a whole and to its member states, but they would like to guide the national cybersecurity strategies in a direction that would contribute to the common European cybersecurity strategy rather than diverging and each one going their own way. Okay. Third key objective is to reduce cybercrime. Fourth, develop industrial and technological resources for cybersecurity. Five, secure critical information infrastructure. Shall we go into a little bit more detail here, as this is of, I would say, possibly increased interest to us. So what are the key performance indicators that are proposed here? First of all, the identification of critical information infrastructures. Has it been done? Okay, and what are we looking for? Well, we are looking for a list of critical information infrastructures at the national level, a list of national critical assets and dependencies, risks and vulnerability registries, CERTS, governmental agency, national security authority, and so on. Okay? So the idea is that if we want to assess this, then we should be looking at that. And again, you shouldn't take this as a tick box approach. Again, looking back at the country with the two critical infrastructures, yes, of course, they have identified their critical infrastructures. But it's not a question of have you done it. It is also a question of how extensively and how well and how documented you have done it. Then, second KPI is risk assessment and risk management procedures and plans, and what we should be looking for there is a division of responsibilities and procedure to be followed. We wouldn't be looking, of course, for the results of risk assessment and risk management procedures, but whether the procedures are in place. Third KPI is set up incident reporting and breach notification procedures. And again, then what we're looking for is whether the strategy describes the procedure, the roles and responsibilities, who is involved, and cooperation between competent authorities, both in the country and between countries. Then design and implement tools that address market failures. And such tools are, of course, the public-private partnerships, breach disclosure regulations. One such regulation which has been working quite well, I would say, is the telecom operators' responsibility, the regulation that they have to abide by, that they have to notify security breaches at the national level to their customers, of course, and also to the European level. And, of course, it's not only a question of notification there, but it's a question of how do we learn from our common problems. Okay. Business recovery and continuity plans for critical infrastructures. And, again, we're looking for strategic documents, for implementation guides, who is involved, who is responsible for that, and so on. Information sharing and trusted cooperation between different players. Are there trusted channels for communication? Are these channels, I would add, efficient? Do we have to physically meet in one place in the case of of an incident to take care of that? Or do we have secure information sharing platforms in place? Faster and more efficient response in case of an incident that occurs at the national level. And this can be measured and quantified by looking at the speed of response and the uncertainty of the response. And finally, the final KPI here is the transparency and the accountability of systems. And again, this is a quantifiable measure. One can look for the number and type of documentation which is available to the public, and also to measure people's awareness. This is not done in many countries. Norway is one of the countries that has done it. There is a study out by Norsis, actually, about the awareness of the Norwegian public towards cybersecurity. Has anyone come across that? It's in, I think I have it in your reading list. I'm not sure, but I suggest that you take a look at it so that you know what the Norwegian people think about their awareness and what the actual level of awareness is. It's a nice report and very professional. And of course, because it is from our partner here, Norsis, we should advertise it. Right? Okay. I would also like to go through the general evaluation objectives. So overall, for each one of those strategies, so evaluations at the program level, and the evidence is whether there have indeed the strategy itself has defined its KPIs and its metrics. Evaluations of implementation, so it doesn't suffice to just have the documents there. One has to look for the implementation, whether the strategy abides by and complies by the international and national legal obligations. For example, this is something which is central in this case. It's the transposition of European laws. Then the budget. This is a more general rule. Never believe a strategy if there is no budget assigned to it. Not necessarily monetary. It could be in terms of resources, which of course translates to monetary. But at least what you would expect in a good strategy, not only cybersecurity, but any type of strategy, would be a clear commitment of those signing the strategy that the resources that are needed to implement the strategy will be made available to those who have responsibility for the implementation. And whether the states work together in cyberspace according to the shared norms, in this case the European norms, and supporting shared values in cyberspace. So, by looking at this, if I then asked you to take some time at home and take a look at, let's say, the Norwegian cybersecurity strategy, right? And do an evaluation of it against the ENISA framework. That could be an interesting thing to do, perhaps. You know, just a quick one. See whether the evaluation tool works fine. In fact, last year, together with SINTEF, we submitted a proposal to the Nordforsk initiative, which is a joint research initiative among the Nordic countries, for a project that, among other things, would look would do a comparative evaluation of the cybersecurity strategies of the Nordic countries, something which has not been done. And, well, of course, we would apply the ENISA framework, but not only this, because this doesn't really look at the societal aspects of a cybersecurity strategy. So what I'm saying is that this is the comparative evaluation of cybersecurity strategies is something that can have research interest as well. Okay? I'm giving you hints for your term paper as well, somehow. Okay, now, too much about cybersecurity. So before closing this, which actually closes session one, and then we will start with session two, is a final note, which is this. So always please keep in mind that we're not only interested about security, but we are interested in fundamental human rights. And one of them is freedom. Well, at that time, the notion of privacy was not there. It wasn't defined until the beginnings, I think, of the 19th century, or the beginnings of the 20th century, maybe the end of the 19th. By the way, this was a president of the U.S., right, at the time. So, yeah. It's the usual debate about security and privacy. Okay? Good. Any questions before I switch to the next one? No? Okay. So, yes?
From my statement from ITU,
yes.
Global Cybersecurity Index has
yes. This is another way of evaluating cybersecurity status, not only strategies. Sorry. The question was what is the positioning of the ITU Global Cybersecurity Index in this discussion about evaluations of evaluation frameworks of national strategies. This is a more generic one, so it doesn't take into account only the strategy, but it looks at other things as well. If you look at the criteria, you will see that it's slightly more generic. But of course, as in every case where you go more generic, then you don't go that much in depth. That's one difference with the ENISA framework. Another one is that it looks, of course, not only at European countries. Well, the ENISA one is designed to comply with the European dimension. Okay. So ITU doesn't have restrictions like that, so it looks at the whole world. It's of course a very useful piece of information. I have used it many times in presentations, bragging about the good position of Norway in this cybersecurity wellness index. I believe Norway is number one in terms of cybersecurity in the region, meaning Europe and Middle East, I think. And it is number two in the world, or maybe number three, something like that. Yeah, but there are ties. And another characteristic of this report, it comes up with results. They're numerical results, right? Which, of course, are a function of different indices that look at individual things. But the range of values is such that there are many ties. So you come up with results that show countries having almost equal or very small differences in their overall rating. Okay. Yes, that also would be nice. I mean, we've just discussed some of the differences. One could, instead of applying, let's say, the one framework to assess different strategies, one could actually look at a comparative evaluation of frameworks that have been proposed for assessing cybersecurity strategies. And there are more. As I said, there are some research papers. I think I can recall at least three that have come up with proposals for such evaluation frameworks. So, yeah, this is a possibility also. One could look at those frameworks and do a meta evaluation, right? So, yes. Did I answer the question? Okay, good. So, well, we will start, even though we have a few minutes left before breaking. So, the agenda for the next session, I really don't know how far we will get with that for today, but we'll try. There are four things I want to discuss with you. How do we identify assets in critical infrastructures, threats, vulnerabilities, and risk? Okay. So, going into part A, which is asset identification, we'll first go through main concepts. Hopefully, will not be the first time that you will be exposed to these, so it's kind of a reminder. Then we'll discuss asset identification methodology requirements, or what requirements we have from any methodology for identifying assets. This also gives you a hint that there are more than one methodology for identifying such assets. What any such process, what components should such any process have? Some examples, and I think there are two or three there. Three, I think, yes. And what are the challenges to asset identification, so as to give you again a hint for further research or delving down into searching. Okay. This of course comes from the ENISA threat landscape, but this is a typical way of showing all the interactions between the main concepts in information security. And actually, I think this comes, yes, this comes from ISO 15408, which is the common criteria, right? Yeah. So, as I said, this is just a reminder of major of the main concepts here. So you can start from any place in the diagram, but the main idea is that, of course, you have assets. These belong to owners who value the assets. Then you have threats against the assets. There are vulnerabilities someplace here that, if exploited successfully by threats, lead to risks. Of course, threats are launched by what we call threat agents. And what is our job? Well, our job is to taking into account the risks to devise, to come up with countermeasures that will reduce the risks. Okay? So this is the conceptual thing of what any security expert would do. And of course, an asset is something that we need to protect. It could be physical, information, software, people, or intangibles. What's an example of an intangible asset?
ID?
ID?
Just my ID or thought or something like that.
Oh, an idea. Yeah, okay, yes. That could be, yes, of course. Anything else? Reputation is the most commonly used one as an example of an intangible asset, right? You have to look at that from an enterprise point of view, from a business point of view. Okay, not from an individual point of view. So yes, of course, ideas are very, very important to businesses. If you are BMW, right, you don't want your next generation designs to become publicly available or available to your competitors, right? And I'm not using BMW accidentally. It's because one of my first European projects that I got involved with, it was inspired by BMW, and it was back in 1988, because they had that exact concern that they wouldn't want their next generation designs to be exposed to cyber threats. Of course, back then, it was a bit difficult to have CAD systems exposed to the internet, but they were looking ahead. Yeah. Okay, it was a nice project. Then harm, of course, is limiting the value of an asset, and then threat is a possible cause that may cause harm. Differentiate between threat and attack, right? I'm not sure that I have a definition about attacks here, but vulnerabilities, of course, are weaknesses in an asset or a group of assets. And then if a threat materializes, it materializes through an attack by exploiting one or more vulnerabilities. That's the relationship between threats and attacks. And then this results into impact, which is just an adverse change of the level of fulfillment of the business goals or the reduction, let's say, of the value of an asset. And all these are examples of possible impact. Risk is the possibility that the specific threat exploits vulnerabilities. We will come back when we discuss in the last part of this session about risk today. I will come back to the definition of risk and the origins. And then safeguard, which is another term for countermeasure, of course, is a measure for managing risk. Residual risk is what remains after we have put countermeasures in place. So, what's the objective of information and cybersecurity in terms of risk? In one line. What are we after? The offer was to mitigate as much as possible of what? Of threats and vulnerabilities. You agree? No? Okay. Risks, exactly. Because a risk is a composite measure of threats and vulnerabilities. You may, in many situations, you may not be able to reduce either the threat, the likelihood of a threat succeeding, or the extent of the vulnerability, in which case you do what? Well, you try to reduce the impact, right? That's the key goal. Meaning, in simpler English, okay, if we can't avoid it, then at least let's maintain a small level of damage. Okay, let's reduce the possible damage. Okay, so another way of putting it, which will also take into account the fact that we cannot diminish completely risk, we will always be left with some residual risk, right? No matter what we do. Okay, so this is probably an iterative process, isn't it? And when do we stop?
Never.
No, that's not an efficient answer. This is a technology answer. The right answer is that you set the limits of your acceptable risk. Okay? And when you reach the level of the acceptable risk as a residual risk, then you simply stop. That's it. You don't go any further. Because going any further will, among other things, will cost you more money than what you will be gaining. Anyway, we'll then move into asset identification. So these were reminders, and I think we can have a break. Okay. Go ahead. The recording is still going on, so yes, we can. We can.
Yep.
Okay, yes. So the comment was that threats and vulnerabilities tend to change all the time. And therefore, We shouldn't stop. Yes, you're absolutely right. I was referring to a static, let's say, risk situation. Obviously, this is absolutely true. So if you take into account the dimension of the axis of time, then of course this is a repeated process. And in fact, in many situations, how do we do that? Well, of course, in the most typical situation, what we do is we repeat the process every now and then, or if we have a significant change in the system and so on, right? Okay. But there are cases in which the risk situation changes much more dynamically than that. And in such cases, what we should come up with is something like, which is usually called a risk engine, which has the ability to, in real time or near real time, adjust the risk levels. Okay? Now, this is a challenging thing to do. Okay? You can imagine what it entails. There are some several research results in this area, but I wouldn't go to the extent of saying that there are solutions that have been commercially available made available for in the market, not yet. So again, subject for glory. Okay, I guess we can start. Eric will pop in sometime. Okay, so coming to asset identification then, that's the first element of risk. We'd like to see how this is done. Of course, the first step is to identify the sectors, and we've discussed this, but this is not enough. So the next step in the process of securing a sector is to come with an understanding of what assets constitute every individual sector. So how can this be done? There are different operators of critical infrastructures, governments and industry. In fact, a little bit later we will come across a term, critical infrastructure owner, which has been coined by the European Union to denote the one that owns or operates a critical infrastructure. And of course, these people are typically having asset identification systems, but these are quite different between them. In some sectors, it can be easy to identify the assets. If you take, for example, the critical infrastructure energy sector, well, factories, power plants, substations, things like that, it's quite easy to identify such physical aspects. But some other sectors are more, let's say, systems-based, in which case it's not that easy to define physical assets. For example, if you take the financial services, the banking sector, or the finance sector, it's not that easy to identify physical assets there. But of course, it is beyond any doubt that there do exist critical assets. So, again, people have been looking at asset identification methodologies, and there are several of those. So the National Information Protection Program, the American National Information Protection Program, as far back as 2009, came up with a set of requirements that such asset identification methodologies should fulfill in order to be efficient and effective. And these are two sorts of requirements here. There are qualitative requirements and quantitative requirements. Let's go through the requirements first. So completeness is a qualitative requirement. That means that any such methodology should be able to examine every relevant asset. This is an extract from NIP, and that's why it refers to 16 critical infrastructure sectors. Of course, this is the American situation. In other cases, that would not be 16. Then another requirement is reproducibility. So what we expect from such a methodology is to come up with consistent results. And these results should be simple and precise enough so that we are able to make risk comparisons across different sectors. Why is that? Why do we need that? Well, first of all, if you take the consistency aspect, well, that's obvious why we want that. I mean, we don't want a methodology that when we apply it now, or if I apply it, I will come up with some results, and then if you apply it, you will come up with different results. That's an excellent sign of a methodology not being efficient, particularly if it comes to identifying assets. But why do we want to enable comparisons of risk between assets across sectors? Is that obvious? After all, aren't we looking at critical infrastructure sectors, each one by themselves? Yes or no? What do you think? No? That means that it's either too obvious or it's not obvious at all, right? Which one of the two is it?
Well, critical infrastructure isn't just one thing, so it they could corroborate in some way?
No. Critical infrastructure is not just one thing, so they could collaborate in one way, was the one answer. This is correct, and in fact, it's part of the answer. Okay, that's a big part of the answer. This has a name. It's called interdependency. So one infrastructure is very likely to be interdependent with other infrastructures, and therefore we should be able to compare risks across. In fact, interdependencies is something that there is a whole session, I think, of Stephen that will be discussing modeling interdependencies. We will encounter the issue of interdependency later today. So yes, this is an important part of the answer. Another part of the answer is that remember that there is, at the national level, a need to prioritize. Okay? So under limited resources, some pertinent and competent body will need to make a decision of how to distribute those limited resources to protecting different sectors of infrastructure. And this is not possible to do unless we can have the possibility of comparing risk between infrastructures. Okay. Documentation. So any such methodology should come up with a record of the information that has been used and how this has been used to come up with a risk estimate. Defensibility. Meaning that there is someone that can defend it scientifically, so it's not an ad hoc kind of thing. This is what we wanted, and this is how we came up with it. Then you come up, you have some quantitative requirements, and these are hard criteria for developing such a methodology. I believe this is the relevant publication there, which you can refer to. And under this class of quantitative requirements comes the asset identification. So there should be, the methodology should offer means for identifying and representing assets for the purpose of criticality analysis, because that's the ultimate goal anyway. Then there should be criteria in the methodology, a list of factors against which the criticality of the asset will be measured. Weighted scoring, there should be some way of allocating scores to achieve a total score that would give you an estimate of the asset criticality. Scoring guides, templates for applying the scoring against the criteria. Means for applying that scoring in an organization. In this case, it would be a critical infrastructure owner or operator. Now, if you look at the... So, if I then give you... Again, giving you a hint, if I give you some exemplars, a couple of exemplars of asset identification methodologies, these are guidelines that you could use to see how you can evaluate such methodologies, right? Okay. Now, but this is not the only one. I mean, these are the characteristics of a methodology. We should also be looking at the process of such a methodology. How does it evolve? If you think of it as a process. And the first thing here is the scope. So there are two kinds of such methodologies. The first one is what we call systematic methods. This is a guided and a comprehensive way of identifying assets and conducting also the analysis of the environment. And then there are unsystematic methods that obviously do not take any comprehensive approach, but they just take individual assets and then they look into that, not necessarily considering all the assets. One would very reasonably ask, but do we want such kinds of methodologies? I mean, are they any good if they are not systematic? Yep. In which case?
If you do the same type of...
Sorry, again. repeating the answer, which actually was in the form of a question, was that the unsystematic methods would give you a chance of looking at what you want to look, which is assets in this case, right? Isn't that what you said?
I don't understand.
Oh, okay, fine. No, actually, my question was, what is the good in that? I mean, if you don't have a systematic way of looking at assets, why do we need such methodology? Do we need to concern ourselves with that? Well, of course it's not perfect, but sometimes you cannot come up with systematic methods, or systematic methods fail to give you a comprehensive picture, or sometimes you don't want or you don't need to look at the overall picture. You need just to focus on specific assets, right? So, yes, it's nice to have systematic methods. That's good. And in fact, engineers love systematic methods. I love them as well. Well, I'm an engineer in deep down. So, but of course, sometimes unsystematic methods can help. Okay. So this was the scope part of the process. Then the assessment approach. There are three cases, I think, here I have. One is function-based approaches. These are also called mission-based approaches. So how do they do the identification? They identify the functions that are critical to the mission of the organization, obviously the owner or the operator of the infrastructure in our case. And then, once we have that, assets that support these functions are identified and they are then evaluated. So we look at what the whole thing does, okay, in terms of functions, and then we identify the assets that are related to that. If you look at business environments, for example, these functions are actually business processes, which are the critical ones. Okay? But it's much more than that if you go into the critical infrastructure domain. Then another approach is the network-based approach, another kind of approach, in which one identifies the nodes and the relationships. So you look at the system, and then you use the system mapping, and you map the system against assets, and that's your evaluation. And then the third option is to have what is called logic-based approaches that, well, this is kind of a, shall I say, political kind of selection, more or less, or maybe ad hoc type of selection. You just select assets based on the best judgment. So you rely on the experts that you have. You ask the experts, what are my assets? What's their criticality? You get the response. You rely on them. That's it. Question, which one of those would you prefer if you were to use one such methodology? And for what reason? Any offerings? Any thoughts? Yes, it does. The answer was that logic-based seems pretty simple. Okay. So you could go for that, right? Okay. Any other offering? It's an argument, yeah. Well, you actually push the tin away from you, right? Because you put it on the experts. So, yes.
Well, logic depends on that you have actual experts that are competent.
Yes. So, I guess this is a counter-argument, that this kind of approach would necessitate that you have really good experts, right? Okay. So, you wouldn't go for that. More well, let's say less confident about using it. Well, you could argue like that, but you know what I would say? Well, I would look at the other characteristics that we mentioned before of the methodology, right? So, a selection of any method for anything is not a one-dimensional kind of thing, right? So, It depends, of course, on the situation, on the exact situation. So there is no generic answer to this. In some cases, you might want to do one. In some other cases, you might want to three to do other things. This is a quick and dirty approach. And, of course, it pushes the responsibility away. But, of course, someone will be responsible for accepting the judgment of experts. Right? Anyway, I'm not trying to push this out of the picture. It's a valid approach because it was offered as a possible response and no one else offered one of the others. That's why I'm concentrating and focusing on this. But I would look at all the characteristics, the desirable characteristics that the method would have, and include the approach there, and then I would come up with a decision of which one to use. Okay? Good. Now, criteria, scoring, and application. Again, well, we want something like that. So the method should be organized around selecting and applying combinations of criteria to asset lists. The criteria should be tailored to the organization. We can't use the same criteria across organizations. But isn't that a bit of a contradiction with what we said before, that we should be coming up with methods that allow for the comparison of risks among different infrastructures? Do you see there a contradiction or not? I mean, if every organization tailors the criteria of the same method, they apply the same method, right? But each one tailors the criteria for scoring to its own organization, would that give us comparable results? Well, I see some negative nods. The answer is that yes, we should tailor the criteria, but we should have a universal or more or less universal understanding of what these criteria mean across organizations. So I'll give you an example. If you have a good old traditional risk analysis method, right? At some point of which, the organization is asked to assess the impact that a specific materialization of a threat would have. Would you expect that impact, the criteria for measuring impact, to be the same from one organization to the other? No, right? Definitely not. They would most likely be different. But the understanding of how to apply the criterion is the same. That means that the risk value that organization A will come up with and the risk value that organization B will come up will be comparable because it already incorporates the subjective view of each one of the organizations, which you don't want to lose. See what I mean? Okay. And after, of course, we have the criteria, they are applied, and the scoring schemes are there, criticality matrices, and other criticality matrix is just a matrix that has assets and the criticality level, which, of course, is flexible. You can define criticality measure, criticality levels on your own to identify the assets. And, of course, there is some line, cutting line, at which we say, okay, the assets below that, they are not critical, we're not interested in them. Well, that's why, that's an answer actually, or a partial answer to the question I asked here, whether this allows us for making comparisons of risk between organizations. So we don't have universal guidelines for that. Now, how do we determine the criticality of assets? Well, we can determine it, first of all, by the position of the asset in the system and the relation. And this usually comes with the network-based approach. And this is the natural thing to do there. There are a couple of publications that you can consult if you want to see how this is done. Or it can be done based on the ability of an asset to meet some predetermined selection criteria. And an example of such criteria is the answer to the question, how much will I lose in monetary terms if this asset becomes unavailable? That's the second, actually, here. Or it could be how many lives will be lost or will be at stake if this asset is not available, or it is disrupted or is compromised. Or it can be based on the degree of change that the degradation of an asset or the loss inflicts on the quality of the provided function, and you can probably see that this is related to the function-based approach. So if we take a function-based approach, this is one of the ways of determining the criticality of assets. Okay, as I promised, some exemplars of such asset identification methodologies. Two come from the States, and one comes from the European Union. So the American National Critical Infrastructure Prioritization Program, how is that being done? Well, there is an annual voluntary data call to nominate critical assets. This comes out from the state homeland security agencies and the federal partners. So there is a call, and then each nominated asset, obviously the organizations to which the call is addressed to and respond, they will nominate assets, and they need to meet two of out of four consequence category thresholds. And these, of course, are set by the state homeland security agencies. And these are used to prioritize the assets. For obvious reasons, or I hope these are obvious reasons, these are not released to the public. You don't want everyone to know what the criticality levels of your assets are. Now, of course, it's not a simple nomination process by just saying, well, yes, this is a good critical asset, so I nominate it. You need to have some realistic scenarios in place to justify the consequence claim. So, for example, if you claim that an asset is critical because the consequence would be loss of life, then you have to come up with a realistic scenario that this will indeed, if this happens, yes, you will have loss of life. And this doesn't stop the process here, but there is a further adjudication process. Are you familiar with the word adjudication? I'm asking because I had to look it up. So don't feel bad if you don't, if you're not familiar. What it means is formal judgment. So actually what this says is that, okay, there are nominations, but these nominations will go through a formal judgment of whether they are justified or not. And this will be done by state agencies and federal partners. So actually what they do is they review those decisions, okay, before finalizing the list. So it doesn't necessarily follow that if you submit an asset and if it is correctly justified, it will find its way into the final list, not necessarily. Okay, so this is how the American Critical Infrastructure Protection Program does it. Then, this is the civilian, or mostly civilian part of it. Okay, now how does the defense, the DOD, does it? Well, in a slightly different way, but the philosophy I think is the same. So this is a 9-step process, and it's mission-oriented. That's natural. And the military think more easily in a mission-oriented way, I guess. I've only served my military service. Well, that's my understanding. It was one year long in the Navy. Yep. Well, fortunately or unfortunately, it was in the research department of the Navy. So I was doing some research on sonars at the time, and also automated torpedo guidance and monitoring systems. It's been too long away, so I can talk about these things. Right? Okay. So it's a 9-step process, starting by the mission and then identifying the capabilities for the mission. The capabilities are broken down into task assets. The task assets are evaluated against 5 criteria. And only one of them has to be met for an asset to be nominated to advance to the next step. The rest are just discarded. Now, those nominated assets, they are validated by the mission owners, and once these are validated, they are then submitted to the joint staff. So it goes up one level. Initial list used to conduct interdependency analysis, so something that might have not made it to that list could also be deemed to be important because of an interdependency analysis. And after the assets have been vetted by the joint staff, obviously this is the highest decision-making authority in the military, then appropriate defense critical assets are nominated, they're reviewed, and then they're either approved or denied. So the resulting list, this is the basis for any other defense critical infrastructure program activities during the next year. So this is, of course, not nine steps here, but it's something, some of them have been suppressed, but it's a quite clear way of doing it. It is mission-based, I would say, and again, the details of how an asset is deemed to be critical or not are left outside in the sense that these criteria are not shown here. Okay, and then the last one, again, I had an unknown word there, is a European one. It goes under the name of criticality, accessibility, recoverability, vulnerability, espiability, and redundancy. And this, I had a hard time finding what it means. It means notoriety, notoriety. Okay. Well, yeah, if you try to the Oxford Dictionary, you won't find it there. But of course, the internet has many, many resources. Okay, so what does that do? Well, it is a non-systematic approach. To give you an example back to our earlier discussion about how good or bad unsystematic approaches can be. So they can be useful. It is unsystematic. It is applied across infrastructure sectors, by operators, by government agencies, and by private industry, to fulfill the need of non-technical need of critical infrastructure analysis. And they are to be used from the policymaker point of view. Engineers like systematic methods, policymakers don't. Unsystematic methods are what policymakers would love, much more than systematic methods. Of course, a good question is, what if a policymaker is an engineer? What role would dominate the other? Would it be the training and the education that one has received? And of course, the mental model that that one uses, or the role in the position? Have you thought about that? Well, you know, I mean, not necessarily policymakers, but in your professional career, you will most probably start by doing engineering work, but at some point you will elevate. You will be asked to make decisions. Will you be thinking like engineers, or will you be thinking like decision makers? Is there a difference? What do you think? Oh. I won't give you an answer. You'll find out. And how does it work? Well, it scores an asset based on six criteria, and which six criteria we know them here. It's those that make up their the acronym of the method. So the criteria is looking at the criticality, the accessibility, the recoverability, and so on. As you can see, it is definitely unsystematic. It is definitely subjective, but it has been used in the European context. Okay, so now that we have gone through the process and some methods for identifying assets, let's see some of the challenges. We have a number of methodologies. Do we have any way of assessing whether they do assess the right assets against the right criteria? Okay, we can apply them. Obviously, the American government does. European nations do. use cover. Do we have any method for verifying the results? Not yet. Is there any way of verifying the results? Of course, you can verify or validate that a method has been carried out correctly. But is there any real way of validating the result of the method, even though this can be can have been correctly applied? So this is one of the challenges. How would one go about it? Well, I'm not really sure how this could be done. One way, one easy way would be to, well, a quick and dirty way, of course, would be to apply at least two different methods and see whether the results are consistent. And we know, at least in other cases, that this is not the case. There are research results indicating that if you use two different risk analysis methods, you will come up with different results, even by the same analysts. Not to mention the fact that if there are different analysts, they would come up with the same, with different results using the same methods. I think, in fact, that Gotewagen, in his course, he did something of an experiment like that. So he had a group of students doing a risk analysis of the same system using one method, and then another group using a different method. And then the results compared, very, very different, as expected, of course. So this was a validation of the research I mentioned. Okay. Now, most of the methodologies we have, they use multiple criteria for evaluating the assets. But scientific support and theoretical foundation are not really there. So these are methods that have been developed in an ad hoc fashion, not really in a scientifically sound sound way. They do work, but they are the result of practitioners rather than the result of scientific research. So, one possibility. Maybe it's a challenge. It could be interesting, so I just repeat it here. It's not my my recommendation. It comes from those guys. To design and validate a methodology that is applicable to all sectors and to all nations. So generic one, to do that. Well, if one could do this, I'll come to how these guys think that it could be done, right? It would be nice to have something like that, because we would immediately have an answer to the question of how can we compare across different nations. So in cases of supranational situations like the European Union or any kind of federation, then we would have results that would be comparable. Can it be done? I don't know. But the suggestion is that it could use a multi-criteria decision-making model to identify the assets. At that level of abstraction, yes, it could work. But I'm not really sure how to go about it. In any case, well, you may want to try. Okay. Now, second part, talk about threads. Any questions until now? Well, we've been doing that interactively, so I guess if you had any, you would have asked. Right? So, let's start with taxonomies. What is a taxonomy, classification of threat types and threats? This can go at various levels of detail. Why do we need them? To establish a point of reference for the threats that we can we may encounter. And then we can possibly change or shuffle around threat definitions. So, obviously some threats are disappearing, some threats are changing from time to time, new ones appear, and therefore a threat taxonomy is not a static thing, it's a living structure, and it's only valid at the time that it has been revised at any time in its life. Now, this and this is a list of taxonomies. Well, obviously, this is not for you to go into each one of them and try to see what each one of them entails and what are the differences and so on. But it's there to show you that people do not really agree on one threat taxonomy. This is an indicative list. Okay. If you're curious enough, you can go into some of them and just click on the links there. Several of them are the result of some European projects. Yeah. I think those here below. Whatever you see with the prefix CORDIS, that's usually a European project. Okay, so obviously we will not discuss them all, but I will give you two of those so that you can see the differences. One is the so-called VITA taxonomy. That was the result of one European project, and it has been described here. This is one of your reading list suggestions. So, what does it do, and why is it, well, interesting? Well, it does differentiate between the threat and intent, which is an interesting approach, not universally taken in such taxonomies. And what is the rationale behind that? Well, the reason being that if you have, let's say, one threat vulnerability combination, this could either be triggered or exploited by nature, or it could be triggered unintentionally, a mistake, or deliberately. Now, why is that an interest to a threat taxonomy, is it? As I said, this is, let's say, one of the unique characteristics of this approach. So there must be something that those that developed the taxonomy must have thought that this is of interest. Any guesses? Well, you don't have all the information, actually. If you haven't read the paper, you don't have all the information to answer this question. But a threat materializes through a threat agent. So one way of modeling the whole situation about threats is either to model threat agents separately and threats separately, in which case, of course, you take the intention out of the threat taxonomy, or you combine those two views in one, and that's what they've done, actually. In the other taxonomy that we will discuss, which is the ENISA taxonomy, you will see that these are two different things. Threats and threat agents are different. So these are incorporated here. They did a thorough job. They came up with over 320 threats. And then these were clustered into two clusters. One, threats to the operational environment, like natural threats, technical, and so on. And the second cluster was ICT-specific threats. So cyber threats affecting malware and so on and so forth. If we go to the first cluster, the threats identified there can either be nature. What you see in parentheses are examples of such threats. Technical threats. Again, some of those examples are quite, it does require some kind of imagination, enhanced imagination, to come up with threats like that. External human activities, neighbors to the facility. Human threats, then, we have external, like strikes and things like that, or internal, like insufficient training of operators and engineers. Human error goes under this one as well. And then you have ICT-specific threats, where this taxonomy classifies under this cluster information assets, hardware, basic software, and application software. So under these categories, there are all sorts of threats related to the cyberspace. And then services under the same one. So critical information infrastructure services and authorized users. The summary of that. 320 threats. Intent is incorporated into the threat. So actually, there is no need to talk about threat agents in this model. And they have been used for subsequent development of risk assessment methodologies in the European project. Then there is the ENISA taxonomy. Obviously, I'm not expecting you to see this, to read this. I can't read it either. But you can, of course, if you go to the threat taxonomy 2016, you will see that. This is only to give you a graphical image of how complex it is. So this taxonomy works like this. There is high-level threats, which is actually used to discriminate families. And then there is threats, various threats, within a category. And then there are details. In this report, you will be able to find details of how these work or how they can be used as part of an attack. And the families then are not very dissimilar. So we have physical attack, either deliberate or intentional, unintentional damage, and these are examples, of course, disaster, failures or malfunction. So you see a mixture of unintentional and intentional threats. Intention is there, is not a parameter here. Outages, eavesdropping, nefarious activity or abuse of privileges, and legal attacks. Now, all these are in the threat landscape picture. In fact, this landscape report by ENISA is quite useful, and I do recommend that you take a look at it every year because it is a meta report. You know that there are several threat reports available. Every major or minor cybersecurity company come up with their own threat report. What these guys do, they don't look at the primary landscape. They take all these reports from around the world and then they produce a meta report. So actually all the information that you can find in these individual reports is collected into one single piece of information, and this can be useful. And what I find very useful also in this kind of reports is this, which gives you a trend, the trends of how threats are developing. So this is the 2016 report has come out in June, I think. And the report contains this table where you can see the trends in 2015, so that's the last year, and the trends in 2016. So what does that, if you look at this column then, what does that tell us? Malware is increasing, malware threats. Web-based are increasing. Web application, denial of service and botnets are increasing. Phishing is almost the same. Spam is going down, and so on and so forth, right? And then the last column gives you a comparison of what has happened this year in relation to the past year. So actually we didn't see any increase in malware or web-based attacks or web application attacks, but there was an increase in denial of service and so on and so forth. And in fact, what is interesting to see, if you look at these reports, I think, are out for several years. So if you take a look, let's say, in the past decade, you will see a very obvious trend in the landscape of threats every year. So things that used to be on the top of the list have moved downwards, and others that have been at the bottom of the list have been moved up. However, I think, I'm pretty sure, that this has consistently been on the top of the list for the last decade. So this is threat number one. Okay, and since it is threat number one, let's just say a few words more about it before we break. And this is again from the same report. 600 million per quarter malware samples. Have you taken Gerulov's course? I recommend that you do. since this is the top threat, then you should know more about it and how to mitigate it. In 2016, mobile malware. Are you doing any mobile malware in the? Well, this is actually quite, it's quite important. You can see the trend here, right? More than 150% increase in the past year. Of course, the nature of the problem and the threat is the same, be it for mobile or non-mobile, right? But the tools we have are quite different. Two important foci this year: ransomware. I guess you all know the WannaCry attack last year, and information stealing. A few years past, this was not the case. So malware was, let's say, not targeted attacks, mostly. It was for fun. New functions, use of anonymization strategies, that's in malware, strong encryption, flexible key management schemes, and most notably, obfuscation methods for detecting payload and so on. Okay, if you want to look at online malware activity, these are probably useful resources, but you may already be aware with them. And before finishing this, I just want to give you a figure from the report, which is useful, to expose you to the kill chain, as it is called. Are you familiar with the term kill chain? Okay. So for each of the threats that is identified in the report, you have a picture like this, and this is the positioning of the threat in the kill chain. So the malware, of course, is up here. Okay. Other threats would look, of course, different. Okay? So I'll see you at 2. Same room, I think.